Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Voice of Olympus, I am proud to bring you Living Hellenismos with Tony Merzwicki. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
Hi, Hercules. How are you today? We're very pleased to have Raven Digitalis on the show today to talk about his book, Esoteric Empathy, A Magical and Metaphysical Guide to Emotional Sensibility. I reviewed Raven's Esoteric Empathy for my Pathos blog, Holistic Spirituality, a few days ago, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about Raven's approach to spirituality. So having snooped on his website, it appears that Raven Digitalis is from Missoula's, Montana, but currently lives in Hawaii. He's the author of The Empath's Oracle, The Everyday Empath, Esoteric Empathy, Shadow Magic Compendium, Planetary Spells and Rituals, and Gothcraft. They're all from Llewellyn Worldwide. He was originally trained in Georgian witchcraft. Raven has been a witch since 1999, a priest since 2003, a Freemason since 2012, and an empath all his life. He holds a degree in cultural anthropology from the University of Montana, co-operated a non-profit pagan temple for 16 years, and is also a professional card reader, DJ, card-carrying magician, and animal rights advocate. Raven, thank you so much for making yourself available and coming on the show. How are you today?
Hello. It's really nice to be here, especially because I'm your first guest, technically, right?
No. We've had guests before, but we had a discussion about having people ring in with questions.
Oh, that's
we've never
right.
actually
oh,
had anyone ring in before. Yeah. We've had a number of guests before. So, you're not dealing with virgins here. This isn't our first rodeo.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and I have fond memories of meeting you at PantheaCon. Back when Shadow Magic Compendium was released, my second book, when I went there, and your workshop was just wonderful. And
thank you. I really enjoyed meeting you as well. You've got a lovely, gentle, calm energy. And I'm so glad that we've reconnected and we've been privately communicating, and I'm looking forward to having even more communications in the future. And I'm so glad I'm going to have you for a full hour to talk about your practices. So
yeah,
I'm going to start off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you say that you've been an empath all your life. When did you first realize this, and how have your abilities grown over the years?
Well, it's an interesting story because when I was 16 years old and in high school, this was shortly after I discovered Wicca, witchcraft, neo-paganism, and some Western magical practices, and was becoming more and more familiar with that and opening my various information centers in the brain and in the etheric body at that time. And those were very formative years. And I would, proudly dress in lots of gothic clothing and makeup, which I often do to this day, but a little more toned down now that I'm 38. But I would also proudly display my pentagram necklace or pentacle necklace. And so I didn't realize at the time that when people would see that necklace, they would unconsciously see it as a source of power and dump emotional energy into that symbol, which would in turn put it into my energetic sphere. And I talk about that in my Esoteric Empathy book as an anecdote, I think the first empathic anecdote in that book. And so what happened one day that really stands out is that I just had this total breakdown in between classes in high school, again at age 16, and I just I just couldn't do it. I just was so overwhelmed with negativity and chaos, and I didn't know what was going on, and I knew it wasn't just mine, but I couldn't understand it, where it was coming from. And luckily, one of my earliest spiritual teachers, mentors, I should say, she lived just blocks away from my high school. So I walked over there, and I was like, what is happening to me? Why am I feeling like this? I don't understand what's going on. And she says, well, you're an empath. And I said, what the hell is that? Like, I've heard of a psychic, but what's an empath? And so, in short, an empath is an emotional psychic. And just like psychicism, everybody has empathy. It's the force of evolution socially. And everybody's an empath. Everybody's a psychic. We just all have these things to different degrees, these different abilities. So that's how I discovered the empathic trait. And I knew that eventually I would share that information with others. So it's a great honor to have published 2 books about empathy and then have my Empath's Oracle card deck coming out in April or May of this year.
Very cool. I'm really looking forward to that coming out.
Yeah, thank you.
Just going off on a little bit of a tangent, that whole episode was triggered by seeing you wearing a pentagram. And a lot of people have misconceptions as to what pentagrams are. How much do you think Hollywood is to blame for misconceptions? People see a pentagram, they think of it as something evil.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I think because the Satanic or the Church of Satan originally, the Levian Church of Satanism originally took the inverted pentagram and put the face of Baphomet on it. That's where I believe a lot of the negative connotations came from with the symbol. And of course, Hollywood took that and amplified it and made it, continued to make it a negative thing until more recent times. In more recent times, it can be seen, you know, more accurately when people do their research, when they're writing shows or movies or whatever. So it's just a star. It's like pentagram just means a five-pointed symbol. It's just a star. It may or may not have a circle around it, but it may be upright. It may be upside down. But, you know, even early Christians, they recognized the pentagram as representing the 5 wounds of the Christ, biblically. And, of course, it was the pentagram was a passcode into the mystery school of You'd Know More About This Than Me, Tony. Which mystery school was that?
Well, it was the Pythagoreans.
Pythagoreans, right.
They would have to draw a pentagram with a circle around it without removing their pen from the paper. That's something I was told years ago, and I assume it's true.
Right. Yeah. You know how I learned that was actually on was from Donald Duck. I literally learned that from Donald Duck. Some cartoon that
it was
historical.
The Sacred Geometry cartoon, yeah.
You know what that is? Yeah.
I've seen excerpts from it. Yeah, it covered Sacred Geometry.
So I learned,
I'm certainly not an expert on Walt Disney, but he did have an interest in esoteric matters. He seemed to have been involved in masonry, and the Disney Club has a doorway apparently that only 33rd degree Masons can go through. It's things that I've heard over the years. There is this spiritual undertone there in Walt Disney's body of work. It's not just kiddies cartoons.
Right. I'm sure there are many research papers and books and things out there about all those deeper layers and levels of Disney before it became the horrible beast that it is now. It is like the Beast of Babylon.
Well, they do have a lot to answer for with what they're doing to things like Star Wars and the like. Things are being modified. They're losing touch with their original body of fans. That's just my opinion personally. Some people may think that they're improving things. I think that they're losing the rawness and the creativity of the original shows. But that's, like I said, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, very true. And at the same time, I look at shows, films like Moana, or like Moana, which takes place in the Polynesian Islands and or Hawaii, where I'm at now, island culture. And it's very positive and true to the cultures and respectful. And then things like Coco and the Book of Life, I'm not sure which of those were by Disney and which were by Pixar, but I do think, and then there's, like even with Frozen, the kiss of true love was her sister, right? Instead of the knight in shining armor. So I think there are some progressive things happening in terms of the film, but maybe not in terms of the monopolizing business. But between you and me and the listeners, I downloaded American Horror Story, the most recent season, and then I got spanked from Disney because they had a tracker and they contacted my cable company internet company, because I don't have a TV, but the internet company, and had all of these warnings from Disney. I'm like, oh, whoa, Disney owns American Horror Story now, and they're spanking me and saying you're going to get fined if you download one more thing. So
wow.
I'm like F you Disney. Whatever.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's all about money these days. Okay, so getting back on track, on page 8 of your book, you wrote something which hit me as incredibly profound. I had a huge light bulb moment. You wrote that empathy is the key to love, and love is the key to enlightenment. The thing is, I've always thought of love as the glue that holds everything together and connects us all. Do you see it the same way? How do you see it?
Most definitely. And although I don't consider myself a Thelemite through and through, Aleister Crowley was most certainly on to something when he said, or when Iwas said, love is the law, love under will, do as thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law. So if, love is the law, that love is the force of evolution, and love, real love, is rooted in empathy, and empathy is feeling for another person, feeling as another person, absorbing those feelings, and truly connecting, and in any kind of relationship, from family, friendship, romantic, if you're really connecting with a person, then you're mutually evolving, I think. And then, like you've been researching, there are so many different forms of love that the ancient Greeks recognized. It's kind of like the ancient Inuit Eskimos recognizing, 50 words, different words for snow?
For snow, yeah.
Similar concept, yeah. So...
So it's interesting that you should touch on Aleister Crowley's 93 current, where the key words in love is the law, love under will, do it, the world shall be the whole of the law, the key words, and that all sum to 93. And the particular word for love that he used was agape. And
agape.
As you mentioned, the ancient Greeks had a number of words for love. And depending on the source that you consult, you come up with different numbers. So there were four which were covered in the New Testament, and agape was one. And then there were, depending on the source, between one and three additional ones on top of that. And then there's also a word in modern Greek. And what I wanted to do was quickly work through those particular words and see how they relate to empathy. Agape is the most obvious one because agape refers to a love for everyone, unconditional love, selfless love, and it includes concepts of caring for strangers, giving charity, and everything else. So, I mean, to me, it's the most obvious correlation with empathy, but I wanted to work through the other ones with you as well. So I'm just picking your brains.
Yeah, I think agape is so all-encompassing because it means not only brotherly love and goodwill, but also the love of God or the gods and goddesses, the love of the divine. So it's I feel like agape is a very encompassing word for love. And so one thing that I wanted to mention is that I think it's very difficult in modern culture around the world for people to say, I love you. I think this is because, in my view, there are a lot of scars and trauma associated with that for a lot of people, where someone might say that and also be abusive in their life. So that could create trauma imprints in a person's psyche. Then at the same time, it's like there are a lot of people who are just, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love everything. And others who only reserve that word love for very, very specific things, whether that's animals and pets only, or if it's after someone's had 6 years of a relationship and then they'll say, I love you. You know, so it's like I wish in modern English there were these different terms for love, because then it's not so intimidating. So, you know, like when I tell my brother, hey, okay, love you, talk later, or my friends, love you, peace. It's like I don't want those to have romantic connotations, but the word love can carry a romantic connotation. So it's like this word love is so too broad in English linguistics. You agree?
I totally agree. And while you were talking, I found myself thinking that what you said was so true, that different people use the term love very lightly. They'll tell a stranger, I love you. Whereas there are others who, as you put it, will wait until they've been in a relationship for 6 years and they're absolutely sure, and then they'll say it. Then there are people who use the term in a manipulative sort of way to get you to drop your barriers. I've got a buddy in my gym. He's a Christian minister, and we tell each other we love each other and give each other hugs. But the thing is, there's no ulterior motive with him. It's just him expressing his love of humanity, and he acknowledges me as someone who's on a very different path to his own, and he accepts me.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So, the thing is, I shouldn't really be talking about him, but he's been through a lot. He served time in prison. He was a skinhead, and now he's a Christian pastor. And because of his appearance, he's been discriminated against. And because he's been discriminated against, he knows how painful it is. And so he makes a point of being loving and accepting to everyone. Whereas with a lot of other Christian ministers, they're so judgmental of you depending on how you look. If you're there in a cardigan and slacks and short back and sides and no tattoos, they'll upper middle class, they'll accept you. Otherwise, you get treated like a leper. Anyway, I don't want to hijack the conversation, but I totally agree with what you're saying. There are problems with the word love because you have to qualify it, whether it's a romantic love or a brotherly love, which there are issues which the ancient Greeks didn't have. So,
exactly.
You know, I mean, for a lot of people, when they think of love, they think of the word eros or sexual passion or sexual desire. I'm not sure if that lends itself to the practice of empathy or not.
I think it's, as far as sexual passion and sensual desire, when it's between two or more individuals, I think it can be a component of agape, of love, but it doesn't have to be necessarily. It can stand on its own, like we see with pornography. Or prostitution. And there's nothing wrong with those fields. It's just that it has the ability to stand on its own, I think. But when accompanied with love and agape, then it becomes a spiritual force, I believe.
I actually just wrote a blog on this, and I uploaded it a few minutes before this podcast, and what you're saying is very much in keeping with the sources that I came across online, that Eros doesn't stand very well on its own. It has to be combined with other forms of love.
Gotcha.
So the next type is philia, which is a deep friendship, an affectionate love, or a soul connection. So, for instance, it can be a love between brothers in arms, you know, mm-hmm. soldiers who go off to battle together. The Spartans capitalized on this, where they encouraged the soldiers to be more than just friends because they were more effective on the battlefield. Because if a buddy of yours is about to be killed, then you're not going mm-hmm. to try as hard to save him as you would if the person was romantically involved with you. You'll try so much harder. And that's actually the cohesiveness which was cultivated by the ancient Spartans. But anyway, I don't want to hijack that.
Yep.
I want your idea.
I totally agree. And the Army of Macedonia? I don't remember. That was completely composed of men who love men, of couples.
Yeah.
What we would call gay couples now. If somebody is intertwined like a brother or like a lover with another person, yes, they will fight for their lives, do anything to save them in the battlefield, definitely. And I suppose that makes it all the more painful considering the deaths that happened at that time. And history is such a difficult beast to look at sometimes.
Yeah, it cuts both ways. So they were a far greater fighting force than they would have been otherwise. But like you said, if any of them were slain in battle, it'd be far more difficult for the survivors, far more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So then does that make it a political strategy? Like a wartime strategy?
A lot of what the ancient Greeks did could be seen as a political/social strategy, where they would encourage bonding between men, and they would remain single until their mid-30s, and then they would procreate after that. So they would encourage young boys to go off with older men and have those older men as mentors. But then in their mid-30s, they would then be encouraged to get married and produce more young boys. So the thing is, their behavior was being controlled. So they weren't allowed to be themselves. They had to be what was best for the for society. And what was best for society was to have them as fighters until their mid-30s, and then be devoted family men and fathers after that. And some guys may be happy with that sort of path. Other guys won't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating to look at that history. And, you know, speaking of, and I'm gay myself, and speaking of homosexual relationships, biblically, there's been so many mistranslations, and I believe there's a new film coming out, what is it, 1943, when there was a new translation of the date that there was a new translation of the Bible that turned the word pedophile into homosexual or something like that.
I'm not sure. You're probably right. But yeah, it sounds like a movie I'd want to see. It's a topic I need to know more about.
Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't for that translation, and I wish I could remember the details about it, hundreds, thousands of lives would be saved right now from hate crimes and suicide. But yeah, that's a dark place to go. So let's get back to love.
Yeah, but I just wanted to say one thing. There's a disproportionate amount of gay street kids, kids that have been pushed out the door by their parents, which is heartbreaking. When I've sat back and thought about what makes parents abandon their parental responsibilities, it's either a staunch religious indoctrination, or it can be drugs, or it can be mental illness. But the natural tendency of parents, I think, is to look after their children and embrace them. I don't understand pushing a child out the door because of their sexual orientation. I can't get my head around it.
Right. And even if they disagree with it, although, you know, the whole born this way thing anyway, but even if they do disagree with it, how does that affect their lives? They're not the ones committing the alleged sin. I think the sin lies in the parents abandoning the children.
I agree. I totally agree. And that's why Born This Way became such an incredible anthem. I've had a number of close gay male friends over the years, and every single one of them has told me that they knew that they were different from an early age.
Yep, me too.
All of them.
You know, I was dressing up like Vanna White from Wheel of Fortune when I was 5 years old. Like,
wow.
And pretending to be Vanna White. Like, and then I asked my mom later, I'm like, how did you not see that? She's like, well, you know, we just wanted to, like, give you the benefit of the doubt because kids are funny and whatever.
Benefit of the doubt. Or some, I think sometimes they think it might be a phase.
Yeah. That's true.
But then again, in the 80s, guys were wearing more makeup than their sisters, you know, during the era of hair metal.
Yeah, hair metal and new wave.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, early goth, post-punk, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so getting back on track, the next type of love is storge, which is familiar love or devoted love. So it's a love without physical attraction, and it's usually the love between parents and their children, which we've just been talking about coincidentally, and so many parents have failed.
Yeah, that ties right in. Storge is that, you know, what's supposed to be unconditional love between family members or adopted family members. So I like that it does not carry romantic connotations. So, again, if we had a word like that in English.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. But I wish that we had a word in English that could communicate that and make the whole word love less intimidating.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
You know, it took
the
It took my dad until about 2 years ago to say "I love you" to me. So a lot of it is generational, also, I think, and he rarely says that, which is fine. It's just it's weird.
But at least
he
said it.
Yes.
There are some parents who go to their graves without saying that to their kids, so at least you have the joy of that. You waited a long time for it, but at least you got it.
Yeah, very good point.
Yeah. So the next type of love is something that you covered in your book. It's philautia, the love of self or self-love. You devoted a bit of attention to the need for self-care, and unless you can love yourself, you can't really love anyone else.
That's right. And there are so many different metaphors and sayings for that. You know, the healer themselves must be healed before they can help another. Of course, everybody has their Achilles heel. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have our challenges. So I think that in a lot of ways that means that we can be loving toward ourselves despite what we perceive as flaws within ourselves. And so much depression and anxiety comes from self-judgment. And when, you know, as a professional tarot reader, the self-judgment comes up over and over for so many of my clients, and it has certainly been an issue in my life, too, that has taken a long time to work with and work through, and I think it's very common in this culture because of what media and society pushes on everybody of how we should be, what we should do, and then that comes with regret and these other negative feelings that boil down to judging the self because one expects that they should. So we've got to do our best to at least look at our positive qualities, right?
Yeah. So I was just wondering, when you read tarot cards for people, if you feel that they're being self-judgmental, it's coming up in their cards, but they might be in denial. Do you kind of push them in the direction to realize that that is an issue for them, or do you just back off? I'm just curious.
Oh, no. I'm the type of reader who will be very forthright and forthcoming if something is an issue. And one thing with the tarot readings, and I only use the Toth deck or Toth deck or the Hooty deck.
That's
you know,
my favorite one, too, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's the only one I will ever use. Especially with that, if there's an issue for the client, it will keep coming up within the different placements of the spread. And I'm like, okay, this keeps coming up. This keeps coming up. It really wants to say this. And so I'm not going to back off if they deny that. I'll be like, well, I'm telling you what I'm seeing in the cards. So if the cards are saying it, and if it's very apparent to me, then this is a real issue. So, you know, I'm not the type to mess around with what's being communicated. And the biggest part also is that readings are solicited. People come asking for advice, paying or trading for the service, and it would be a disservice for me to beat around the bush, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if they don't like it. And even if it means they won't return to me as a client, I'm still going to tell them what the cards are saying.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I can see that you have a responsibility to let them know things, even if they don't want to hear it. And if they don't mm-hmm. come back, then they're just not ready to hear it at that point in time.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so the next form of love is ludus, or playful love. So it's the affection between children, and also it's the affection between lovers, the flirting, the teasing in the early stages of a relationship. And one author I came across actually says that dancing is a pure expression of ludus. It's not sexual, but it's sort of flirty and all that. And I was thinking while I was getting my blog together of I was imagining you in goth clubs, you know, dancing away and everything else. So I can see you playing with that concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when I was a goth industrial, et cetera, dark wave radio DJ for 19 years back in Montana. And I played quite a few gothic club nights as a DJ. And then, you know, of course, touring around the country, I was able to go to numerous goth clubs. So in all those cases, and especially when I was DJing, I would dance with that, flirt with that, put on a veil, do, you know, dance in very mysterious, dark ways, however the music would take, without care how others would see it. It's like, so that I think would fall along similar lines in that paradigm.
Okay, we're almost there. The next type of love is pragma, or mature love. So it's probably the polar opposite of ludus, which was a careful and playful love. Pragma is a long-term mature love. It's something that's beyond the physical, that's transcended the casual. It's what keeps a relationship going for years and years, and it's the thing that's missing in so many relationships that end in divorce.
So how do you feel like that is activated and applied within romantic relationships, partnerships, the pragma?
I think that it's something that takes a lot of work. It's not that exciting. You have to develop mutual respect with your partner. You've got to be considerate of them. You have to support them. It is very much a form of love where you're putting someone else's needs on the same level as yours, possibly even greater than yours. Yeah, I think of people who have supported their partners over the years. Like, remember Maggie Thatcher? Her husband would just sit there in the back room. He was always supporting her. And there are often couples where one is prominent and the partner sort of sits back supporting them. So you've got this self-sacrifice. This is supposed to be your interview, not mine, dude.
It's okay. I'm loving it.
But we're sharing ideas anyway. I think we're pretty well on the same page for just about everything anyway.
Right, but, exactly.
So I've just got two more types of love, mania or obsessive love. It's where someone develops an unhealthy obsession with a particular individual. So it's what leads to stalking and dependency, possibly even violence.
Interesting.
Is that something that could be addressed with empathy?
That's a tough question. I'm going to be completely honest. I felt that towards somebody for a couple of years, and it was not reciprocated, but it turned into that type of fascination, obsession almost with this person. And because it was not reciprocated and I wanted so much for it to be, it led to places of madness. At the same time, I really tried to control it and not make it a violating thing. Because I have had stalkers. I've had quite a few stalkers before as a public figure. And, like, that's not comfortable. I wouldn't want to put anybody through that. So I tried to control it the best I could. But it definitely flirted with that manic kind of energy. So I think that there is so much... There is a lot of empathy there, but then I feel like that empathy gets almost replaced or superseded by expectation and desire and things that are unhealthy to feel toward another person if it's not reciprocated. So I think... That really is a difficult one, because if empathy is truly there in that state, then the person would pull a Mariah Carey and, you know, let the butterfly go, and if it comes back, then it's meant to be, and do that whole thing. Mm. But not everybody does that, and depending on the constitution of any given person, they can take it to a very darkly obsessive place that is violating. And if it becomes violating and is crossing another person's boundaries, that's where empathy fails, because it's not empathizing with the other person's needs and desires.
No, because you're imposing your will on them.
Right.
Rather than being receptive to their needs, you're putting your needs first.
Right. And if it's shared, wonderful. But if it's not shared, you know, whole different things.
I think almost every relationship is obsessive in its early stages, when you're first getting to know the person, but then it should fade into something a little bit more controllable. But if it doesn't, that's when you start running into problems.
Right.
Can you think of any sort of spiritual exercises that you could do to, not you specifically, that one could do to rein in obsessiveness like that?
The biggest thing I can think of is, one, therapy, and two, deep meditation and contemplation. And ritual work, spiritual work, however one does that, prayer, meditation, that is something that permeates all spiritual practices, including Christianity and Islam and Judaism. And it's not, you know, meditation is something that is global, worldwide. And of course, that meditation doesn't just mean clearing the head so you have no thoughts in your brain. That's never what it's meant to be, but rather reflection, and there's countless forms that meditation can take. So I think it's that whole soul searching and being realistic about a person's circumstance and about the dynamics of the connection that can really provide the answer. Honesty, to find that honesty.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't expecting this interview to get so heavy.
No.
But I'm sure there's someone listening to this who's going to derive benefit from it. They'll either be on the receiving end of obsessiveness, or and someone will get value from this. I mean, this is too profound an issue to just evaporate into the ether. I'm sure someone's going to get some sort of benefit out of this.
I agree.
I also really value your honesty and your approach, that introspection, and also have the strength to seek out a therapist. When I was growing up, the idea of seeking out a therapist was something that just wasn't talked about. It was taboo, but times have changed. And I've come to the stage now where I think just about everyone could do with a little bit of therapy, you know, be given a few coping skills and the like.
Yes, I think everybody can use a therapist. Maybe not all the time, but I think it should most definitely be something that is funded, governmentally funded, as a human need, like any medical issue.
Yeah,
I see a therapist now. I've seen probably 5 therapists in my lifetime, and they've helped with different things to different degrees. My current therapist has helped the absolute most when I needed it. It's an incredible match. I heard from a friend in England a number of years ago that therapy is like a dirty word, and they can't understand why people in America and Canada, for example, would be like, oh yeah, my therapist said this, you know, just in casual conversation, where it's not a shameful thing. So how was it for you growing up? It sounds like it was a kind of a shameful thing, or something you don't really talk about with others, right?
Yeah, it was a matter of shame. I think for my generation and the previous generations growing up, any sort of mental illness was hidden away. You've probably read of accounts where people would get shut up in asylums for years and never talked about. There are even members of the royal family who've been shut away in asylums because they don't want the public thinking that there could be an issue with the bloodline, because it's not quite as diverse as it should be, and it's led to mental illness. But I find that in this country, there isn't as much stigma talking about therapy. A lot of people talk about therapists, and one of my favorite movies is Freaky Friday, and Jamie Lee Curtis actually plays a therapist in that. Yeah, and
that's right.
She kind of and it's such a fun movie. I like to see that movie about once a year or so.
And then Lindsay Lohan swaps places.
Yes. And I mean, I'm not an expert on movies or anything else. One of the things that I look for is growth in the characters. And what happens is that Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis both grow as individuals. And the movie then comes to a resolution. Once they start putting each other's needs first, then the spell's broken. Touches on all the love that we've been talking about.
How funny that all of this would lead down to Freaky Friday. that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Strange.
Where were you
things
born
have happened.
Again? Yeah.
Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, I thought it was Sydney, yeah. And, of course, much more highly influenced by the UK than here in America. So similar stigmas would probably carry over.
We actually had a mixture. The thing is that it was cheaper to pay for the rights to screen a show than it was to make it at home. So I grew up with a lot of shows that the Brits had and a lot of shows that you had. So if you talk about shows you grew up on, things like Gilligan's Island, Lost in Space, I grew up with all those.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, so Last Kind of Love wasn't really talked about in ancient Greece. It's a modern Greek concept, and it's meraki, which is a modern Greek word derived from the Turkish word merak, which means to do something with love, creativity, and devotion, when you wholeheartedly put yourself into what you're doing. So it can refer to artistic expressions that you really enjoy, and you're good at like painting, singing, or composing music, but even cooking a nice dinner for someone and can be an expression of meraki. And I mean, I personally find sharing a meal with someone to be an incredible bonding experience. And now I have a word for that experience, meraki.
Mm, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. And cooking for someone or sharing food, which is essential for life, sharing drink even, whatever it is, bonding that way is so important to upholding social connection. And that is art itself.
Yeah.
And when a person makes art of any kind, whether it's sculpting, painting, writing, performance art, anything, theater, it goes on and on. Art is limitless, and that's something I like to talk about in some of my books as well and articles, mm-hmm. is that art is limitless. It has so many forms and or boundless, I think would be a better word for it. There are no boundaries for art. So, which reminds me that when shortly before moving to Hawaii about 2 years ago, I had two of my wonderful artist friends help me create a Facebook Live and YouTube video which was basically my own ritual of shedding the past and embracing the future. And it's on YouTube. If anybody looks up Raven Digitalis performance art, they can see that. But it starts in this happy place and then goes to this very dark place. And then it comes back up into this place of hope. So that, for me, was like the artistic expression that I needed for transitioning into a new life, basically, a whole new life, because I had grown up in Missoula and had never lived outside of there, but the universe guided me very specifically to Kauai Island, and I said, okay, this is what needs to happen, and it was the biggest and bravest change I've ever done. So... So it felt right to make performance art leading up to that. And it's kind of a disturbing piece for a lot of people. But I have a lot of warnings on the YouTube video. This is not for everyone. It can trigger dark things and so on and so forth. But I think things like that, when people are feeling overwhelmed or they're feeling an influx of energy and confusion, depression, anxiety, don't know what to do with it, going to art, going to expression of any kind is so therapeutic. And then I suppose in a Greco-Roman sense, that form of love would connect to the muses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so with the muses, we have those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty well traditional for poets and writers to call on the muses, the nine muses, before starting any sort of endeavor. And in Herodotus' book, Theogony, Hesiod's Theogony, he starts uh-huh. off by calling on the muses. And I actually
right.
wrote a blog about a year ago about one of the muses in particular, Terpsichore, who's the muse for dancing. I do a bit of photography work, mm-hmm. and I've been photographing jazz ballet dancers, and I've really enjoyed watching their creativity. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to write a blog to help them bring in the particular muse that presides over dancing? But most of these girls are Christians, so they weren't interested, mm-hmm. but it was an interesting exercise anyway.
And, you know, that reminds me of here in Hawaii, there, of course, is hula, the ancient art of hula mm-hmm. dancing. And hula, all within hula, all of the movements and motions are symbolic of something, just like you would find in ancient Indonesian or Indian theater or Japanese theater, ancient Chinese theater. Everything is symbolic of something. And there is a certain goddess who oversees hula as an art, as a dance, as a communicating with the gods, ancient gods and goddesses. So honestly, it kind of, okay, not kind of, it really pisses me off that Christianity has such a hold on local Hawaiians and local everybody in all the island cultures. In so many places, Christianity or Islam has taken a hold and stomped out the old gods and goddesses. And however, you know, I did graduate in a cultural anthropology degree in Montana. Mm-hmm. However, so I did learn, however, at the same time, for many people and many cultures, they're not mutually exclusive. So
I hate to interrupt the conversation, but we have around 3 minutes left, so I just wanted to let you guys know.
Oh, thank you, Hercules. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice. I'm listening. It's the whole show.
Wonderful. Dan, we're really running out of time. Look, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed your book, Esoteric Empathy, and one of the things I loved about it was that you cast your net out very wide. You discussed a broad range of spiritual practices, and it appears to me that cultivating whatever innate empathic skills we may have may help us in whatever path we choose.
Sure, yeah. Yep, empathy can exist in any and every spiritual path, or even lack thereof. It's our culture, it's evolution, it's humanity, and it's also within empathy is seen within animals as well, and within plants as well. It's fascinating, endlessly fascinating. So yeah, thank you for the wonderful review about my Esoteric Empathy book. I feel like that's my baby. That's the number one book that I've created. It's my favorite. It took so many years, 6 years to research, write, create, and edit, etc. And that's where my heart is, and hence the heart chakra symbol on the cover of the book.
That doesn't surprise me at all, because the feeling that I had as I was reading the book was on how much love and how much work went into it. It really was a labor of love. We're running out of time. How can people get in contact with you, possibly engage with a tarot reader or look into whatever projects you have happening, website contact details?
Sure. So basically, Raven Like the Bird and Digitalis, which is the Latin name for foxglove, just look up Raven Digitalis. So you can go to facebook.com/ravendigitalis, instagram.com/ravendigitalis, or ravendigitalis@gmail.com, or www.ravendigitalis.com. So, you know, I'm all over the place just with the same moniker, and people can ask me about books and autographed books as well, and book tarot readings, which usually lasts about an hour, and we can do that over audio or video anywhere in the world.
Wow. Fantastic.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, Hercules, for having me here. I really appreciate it. It's been an honor, and I look forward to next time.
I was just going to talk about next time when your deck comes out. I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah, I'd love to. So
that'd be so cool.
April or May, my deck will come out, and it's called the Empath's Oracle Deck. So if anybody goes to ravendigitalis.com, they can see a description of that and also see the artist in Germany, my friend Constantine Bax, who did the incredible artwork for it. It's like nothing you've ever seen.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait to see it, and can't wait to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, mate.
Mate.
I had to drop a mate in there.
And thanks to everybody who tuned in tonight. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures.
Agape.